satellite, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
Another edition of American Exposé. It's the 30th of August. One more day of August, and we move into September and the anniversary of September 11th, 2001. The Republican National Committee's doing their thing right now with the Republican National Convention. Keep in mind, in their elephant, they have three stars. Those stars were turned upside down some years ago. So what is that telling us? The Congressional Medal of Honor, upside-down five-pointed star. Sorry to say, that's a satanic symbol. Well, the Republican National logo, the elephant, with the three stars, they've been turned upside down as well. So what do we get, Ira? We get a slow implementation of the New World Order with the Republicans and a fast implementation of the New World Order with the Democrats. Is that what we get, Ira?
That's it. Yep. So, yeah, they're having both of these conventions, Chris, but and they have different candidates for them, but the whole thing is connected. I mean, you can, whether they're a Democrat or Republican, there's nothing going to change when whoever goes in office.
Now, listeners, this is Ira from Moffat, Colorado. We've spoken to him before, and he's totally tuned into the big picture in place, aren't you? From your years of research, isn't that correct?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've tried to prove yourself wrong, I suppose, at times, haven't you?
Oh, I have. I've just picked up everything I could find just to, you know, and even spent quite a few dollars trying to prove something that I had found was wrong. I'm a retired military man, and when I joined the military way back years ago, it was a good job to begin with, but it was also the thing I wanted to do. And so I did it. And but in the course of my duties with the military, I learned a lot of things that I sometimes wish I didn't know, really, to be honest with you.
When did you join the military?
Well, the first time was in 1946. I joined the Navy.
Uh-huh.
And I served 2 years from 1946 to 1947. And I got out of the Navy and stayed out for about 3 years. And then went back into the Air Force, and I did my rest of my duty in the Air Force.
Uh huh.
Yeah, my career. So.
And how long did that last? Did you?
20 years.
20 years in the military. My goodness.
Yeah. So. Well, like I said, I learned a lot of things that I wish sometimes wish I didn't know. I'd probably be happier if I didn't know it, you know. And
sure. But you can't help it.
No, you can't. I mean, in one sense of the word, I'm glad I found it out. And in another sense, you know, it's as far as my daily life is concerned, it can get rather hectic at times. So,
well, here you joined the military in 1946 at the conclusion of the Second World War. And
right, uh-huh.
Then we jump into Korea a few years later, and then you're seeing a U.N. flag for the first time in the military.
Yeah, well, I got back into the Air Force just in time to land right in the middle of Korea.
Is that right?
Yeah, and so.
Do you have to get that?
No, no, okay. that's a fax phone there.
I see. Okay, now, so you rejoined the military into the Air Force for Korea, and you were pretty surprised when that happened, I suppose.
Well, no, not really. It had been talked about, and there was things going on there. But the thing that I got really disappointed with was the fact that we were sent to Korea without permission of Congress. Congress wasn't even involved in it. Harry S. Truman was the president at the time, and he through the United Nations, that's what it was really, got the U.S. involved in that Korean mess over there, and we spent a number of years there. That was and that's the way it happened. That was the first time in the history of the United States that the U.S. military was deployed without Congress taking some action on it.
Uh-huh.
But on that one, they never did. And the reason they did, that Korean War was referred to as a police action, not a war. And that's the reason nowadays you don't hear too much about it. But, all the American troops were supposed to have been pulled out of there after this war was over.
Mm-hmm.
But that was over 50 years ago, and we still got troops in South Korea.
Yes.
So, yeah. So
It did. They talk about a redeployment, but it's a redeployment for a United Nations Rapid Reaction Force is what they're redeploying for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all of these little wars we've had since World War II. As a matter of fact, World War II was the one where the politicians snuck the United Nations in on us. You know, that a lot of people think that the United Nations didn't come into being until 1945, but it was actually formed up in 1942. And the so-called Allied forces fought under the jurisdiction of the United Nations all during World War II. Now, we didn't, the charter wasn't signed, or the Senate, the U.S. Senate, never accepted the U.N. Charter until 1945.
Right.
But it was, we were under the jurisdiction of the United Nations long before then, so,
And that just verifies what I've been saying.
Yeah.
And most listeners know. So there's no doubting that now that you've corroborated what I've said. It's just a sad, sad commentary that we live today in 2004, moving into 2005, as the implementation process of this UN system is in our face today, and most people don't realize it. Isn't that correct?
Well, that's right. They don't. Talk to a lot of people or try to even tell them that the United Nations is giving the orders in all of this mess, and they won't believe you.
Yeah. Even some talk show hosts.
Yeah.
Many talk show hosts.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have a clue.
No, they don't. And they don't take time to corroborate what you tell them, you know, to prove it or whatever, or disapprove it, whichever. And because they're so convinced that they're right until that this government can do no wrong. And, but I got news for them, Chris.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's, yeah. I have an email on my computer here a couple of days ago, and the sender said that if we don't straighten it out this time, it'll be our last chance. He's talking about this election that's coming up.
Uh-huh.
Well, we already know, I think, that at least folks like you and I know, that the next president has probably already been picked.
Right.
And they know who he's going to be before the election even comes up. And going to the polls is pretty much a waste of time as far as the presidential and national election is concerned.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that we realize, you and I and a handful of others out there, which gives us little feeling of helping. I don't know. I'm sort of at a crossroads myself about all this. With the remaining days we have, what is the proper thing to do?
Well, I don't know, to be honest with you. As we look back in the history of elections, for more years than you and I have been born, either the Democrats or the Republicans have ruled this thing.
Right.
It dates all the way back to 1960 when Abraham Lincoln was elected, or to 1860.
Right.
That when Abraham Lincoln was elected, he was the first Republican president. And from that time on, every president has either been Republican or Democrat. And an independent candidate in a presidential election doesn't have a chance. So I don't really know what the answer would be. Unless, you know, you could get enough people, be about the only thing, and which, with the time left to this election, it would be almost impossible to do,
mm-hmm.
to get enough people to vote, to just to write in some candidate or other, and not vote either Republican or Democrat.
What would you think about that as far as, wouldn't that be something to get Kerry in place? Of course, we already think that maybe he's there, huh?
Well, I think Kerry, I mean, this is only my opinion here, but I get the feeling that John Kerry has already been picked by the Council on Foreign Relations to be our next president.
Mm-hmm.
I think he'll win this election. I hope I'm wrong, but I'm afraid I'm not. But if I am, I'll be happy to be wrong for at least once in my life.
Well, that's the sad thing, is that we have these directions, Tweedledee, Tweedledum, and yet I'm sure you noticed the Olympics were on. And here they have this transfer over to China for the next elections, and they always use the word China and never put communist China in front of it today. And that's a conspiracy in itself, almost.
Oh, yeah, it is. Well, this whole thing is, you know, this New World Order thing. This has been in the mill for a lot of years. That was a scheme that was hacked up way back, 400 or 500 years ago, when the an outfit over in Europe called the Illuminati. This was some disgruntled Catholic priest that he got disgusted with the Catholic Church, and he started his organization, which he called the Illuminati, and his whole idea of the whole thing was to set up this new world order, this one world government, that because he figured that was the only way that was ever going to be any peace in the world. That was his opinion. That's what the story he put out. Now, whether he actually believed this, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the story that he put out way back in the 1600s. I don't remember the exact date, but it was 300 or 400 years ago when this thing started. And it's grown by leaps and bounds, and there's a whole mess of other organizations, world organizations, that's involved in it now. Like England, it's the Round Table, they call it, which is the English version of the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations. And then there's the Trilateral Commission, which is the executive officers of the Council on Foreign Relations. And they have their own meetings or whatever, and but it's all tied in with this Illuminati that started, and the Illuminati means the enlightened ones, in mm-hmm. case somebody don't know. And so this enlightenment that they're, and that the New World Order and this one world government has been the goal for this thing ever since it was organized way back there. So.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another organization, and that it's an organization of world bankers that's called the Bilderbergers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of our politicians that are members of that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just another branch of the Illuminati. It's all the same thing. And it's all working toward the same thing. And whether this thing would have such a hold on world politics right now to realize its dream, that remains to be seen, really. But the deadline for that is 2005. And I think the last time we was talking, Chris, I said something about the reason why that it didn't happen in 2000 was when that was the original deadline. And the reason it didn't happen is because there were certain people in Washington that were pushing this gun confiscation thing that they didn't get their law passed. And so there's still a lot of private weapons out here, and so that's kind of putting a crimp in their plans to whatever they want to do here, because that was the reason why that the Japanese, back during World War II, after they bombed Pearl Harbor, they had destroyed our defenses coming right on into the United States. They wouldn't have been nothing left to oppose them, and they could have landed on the west coast of the United States. Very simple. But it's like one of the admirals said, one of the Japanese admirals after the war was over, and somebody asked him, well, why didn't you just do that? Why didn't you go ahead and attack the United States? He said, because we knew about your private-owned weapons in the United States, and said, we could have took the United States militarily, but we couldn't have held it, because the people would have rose up against us with their private own weapons. And that's the whole bottom line of trying to all of these gun control things, which is strictly unconstitutional.
Yeah.
There's the Second Amendment clearly gives us the right to own weapons and our personal weapons, but and now they're trying to interpret this thing in a lot of other different ways, and so that it'll give them the right to take them away from us, you know, and that. So,
yeah, it's ridiculous how you see the morals, the dropping of the morals many years ago, and the destruction of the family unit, bringing to the gang violence today, and yet the guns are vilified.
Yeah, Chris, back when I came home from World War II and got out of the Navy, all of this new morality, they called it at the time, was taking hold in this country. This was around 1947 and 48, somewhere along in there, that this thing was beginning to take shape. Well, by 1960, the whole thing was in complete control, because every time you turn around, every time you tried to do something, why, there was a bunch of what was known at the time as flower children, that some people connected them with the hippie generation, but the flower children and the hippie generation was two different outfits altogether. Now, I had some very good friends that referred to themselves as hippies, and still do, some of them. And the flower children were people like Bill Clinton, for instance. People with a lot of influence and a lot of money. And they're the ones that rigged up this new morality thing that has been ruling the roost, and that's where all of these non-government organizations like the Nature Conservancy, the Sierra Club, the Audubon Society, and all of those things, that's where they arose from, is right out of that flower child movement or whatever.
Well, they're big now, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. They're strong now. And another thing that a lot of people don't know is the fact that all of these NGOs are working for the United Nations, not the United States. And they're taking their orders from Kofi Annan, not the President of the United States. And that's one thing that we really need to get clear, that all of this environmental stuff that they're pushing, and which you and I both know, I mean, the environment is important. We have to admit that. But they just go totally overboard with this environment thing.
Oh, boy.
And, yeah. And, like, for instance, you're in the San Luis Valley. Prairie dogs, for instance, are on the endangered species list. And those things multiply like flies in a sugar barrel.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I mean,
so there's not much need for them to be an endangered species?
No, there's no reason at all for them to be an endangered species, but they are.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really go to jail right here in Swatch County. You can go to jail for killing a prairie dog.
Hmm.
So, of course, they're about the most destructive things you've ever seen. They can ruin a hayfield in just a few days.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because they tunnel underneath all of the roots in the hay, and they eat the roots, you see, that from alfalfa roots. And they can ruin a hayfield in just a short period, just a week or so.
You're in Moffat, Colorado. How long have you been there?
Since 1981.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we came here. I got out of the Air Force in 1969, retired.
Uh-huh.
Just my return from Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And we was home down in Florida there, and of course all of our kids had done found them new mailing addresses or whatever. And then, so we were sitting around the house and had nothing to do, so I told the wife, I said, let's just go see the folks. She said, okay, so we gathered up a few rags and threw them in the car and took off. And we didn't get back for two, 3 years, and about 3 years. And we found the San Luis Valley on that trip, and that's where we decided to settle down. So that's why we're here. And we got here in 1981. We've been here ever since. So.
Now, you did spend a term in Vietnam. How long were you in Vietnam?
I was there for 1 year.
And what was your experience during that experience?
Well, this was, for one thing, I was the munitions control officer for Southeast Asia, and I was doing this as an enlisted man. I was asked if I would take the job, and I said, well, if you'll give me the rank to go with it. And the colonel said, well, we can't do that, but said, you can handle it with your enlisted rank. So I did for 1 year. And I heard a lot of things about, well, I was in touch with the troops around over in, you know, the different, because they had to come through me to get their orders for ammunition field. But there was a little something there that kind of put a crimp in things, because I couldn't legally fill an order for ammunition until I received word from Washington, D.C., from the Department of Defense. In Washington, D.C., I had to just hold on to the... of course, sometimes I did. I went ahead and done it anyway, but if I could get by with it.
Well, why do you think that was the case?
Because we were pawns in Vietnam. This was a part of this New World Order thing. And, Chris, they've got to stop the United States before they can ever form up this New World Order, because right now there's enough people here in this nation that would oppose anything like this till it just can't be done right at the moment. And because what it would do is just cause a lot of bloodshed right here in this country if they tried to do it. That's the reason it ain't been done already. And
So when you were in Vietnam, and there was a waiting game going on, wasn't there?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was... Well, the whole thing was a kind of a waiting game. It's like you don't fire until fired upon. Well, if you was fired upon, it was too late to fire. You know, you couldn't... You wasn't able. And because... Those guys were, boy, they didn't miss with those rockets.
Where did North Vietnam get their equipment to fight us?
Oh yeah, now they. I'm going to give you a story here that a lot of people don't believe, but I was in command on a night shift there in the ammunition depot in Phan Rang, Vietnam, one night, and there was a, they had a habit that they would hit us with a small force just before dark, and then they'd check us out to see what our strength was, and then around 10, 11 o'clock at night, they would hit us with the main force, with the big one, and
I'll tell you what. Night, keep your thoughts in place. I hear that we're going to go to commercial pause now.
Oh, okay.
And I don't want to get interrupted in the middle of this. And once again, listeners, this is Ira from Moffat, Colorado. He's spent a lot of years researching what the hell we're under today. And we've led up to a point where the implementation of this is coming under Agenda 21, correct?
Right.
We're going to be back to continue with Ira, listeners. Sorry to be the giver of this bad information, but shoot, that's all I've ever been doing for 8 years, so stay with us. We'll be back to continue with Ira from Moffat, Colorado.
listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. What should the true Christian response to the homosexual marriage license debate be? It should be the same response that Christians should have had to marriage licensing in the first place. The very definition of a license demands that we not obtain one to marry. Black's Law Dictionary defines license as the permission by competent authority to do an act which, without such permission, would be illegal. We need to ask ourselves, why should it be illegal to marry without the state's permission? More importantly, why should we need the state's permission to participate in something which the Creator himself instituted? We do not need the state's permission to marry. What if you apply and the state says no? You must understand that the authority to license implies the power to prohibit. A license, by definition, confers a right to do something. The state cannot grant the right to marry because it is a God-given right. Should homosexuals have the right to obtain a marriage license? Let them grovel before their God, the state, for permission to do that which is unlawful in the eyes of the Creator. What should we do? Christian couples should not be marrying with state marriage licenses, nor should ministers require them. Some have said, if someone is married without a marriage license, then they won't really be married. Given the fact that states may soon legalize same-sex marriages, we need to ask ourselves, if a man and a man marry with a state marriage license, and a man and a woman marry without a state marriage license, who's really married? In reality, this contention that people are not really married unless they obtain a marriage license simply reveals how statist people are in their thinking. We need to think biblically. You should not be required to obtain a license from the state to marry any more than you need one to be a parent, which in some academic and legislative circles are currently pushing to be made law. But that is another topic. This free speech moment has been brought to you by FirstAmendmentRadio.com. If you can hear my voice, you are listening to the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network. If you would like to continue hearing these programs, there are several ways that you can help. One, you can make a donation or subscribe to your favorite program by going to FirstAmendmentRadio.com on the Internet and follow the instructions there. Two, you can sponsor your favorite program with your business advertising dollars or spend your dollars with those businesses that advertise on your favorite programs. Three, simply call in on live programs and tell them that you are listening on FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Now, anyone can do that one. You can find the call-in numbers on our schedule pages at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. And finally, you can call 559-733-5002 and leave your name and address, and we will send you a support pack. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Chris Gerner with the broadcast American Exposé. Go to the website AmericanExpose.com and you'll learn more about the Congressional Medal of Honor, the upside down five-pointed star, and the logo for the Republican group with the three upside down stars now. They were turned upside down some years ago, I'm told, but it's indicating of what's going on today. But we're picking Ira's brain about his experiences in the past. And we're in Vietnam now. Continue with your thoughts, Ira.
I was just this little episode that happened there. It was, I was in command at the bomb dump that night. And we had been hit earlier, of course, like I mentioned a while ago. And we knew they were going to come back. I mean, they always did in situations like this. And, it was about 10:30, 11 o'clock that night that we did get hit. Of course, we were ready for them. And, earlier, our commanding officer had showed up. And he was drunk. I mean, just crocked right out of his mind.
Mm.
And so due to the conditions there, Chris, I locked him in his office and wouldn't let him out. and went ahead, and we took care of the situation there.
Uh-huh.
And the next morning, I sent out a detail to check this field where the cones were coming from. And they gathered up over 700 weapons out there in the middle of that field, and every one of them was American-made.
Hmm.
Every last one of them.
Really?
Yeah. Now, I've been called a liar on that a lot of times. But I was there, and I saw the weapons, and I know, and so I'm not lying, no matter what anybody will say. It's a fact. That night, during all of this process, I had set myself up for a good long hitch in a federal prison. Of course, just slapping that colonel was enough to get me 5 years, if he'd have pushed it.
Uh-huh.
But he decided not to. After 10 days, he decided not to. And so he and I partied real good friends in all of this, but there was some pretty ticklish moments there for just a short while. So. And that's the kind of a situation it was. I told my troops, the ones under my command, I said, gentlemen, the whole thing here is survival. That's the whole idea. So you just stay alert and stay alive until you can get out of here and catch the first airplane home that you can get on. So
that must have been pretty demoralizing to you.
Oh, it was. Demoralizing to everybody there. I mean, these guys were, the morale was just about as low as it could get. And the only reason, the only thing the guys were after was just to get the hitch over with and get home. And I told mine, that's to do that. I said, you just stay alert and stay alive until you can get out of here.
Most of your other fellow soldiers in Vietnam had lofty ideals before they came over there, didn't they?
Well, yeah, a lot of them did.
They thought the whole reason was to stop the flow of communism?
Well, that's what they thought that was all about, but I don't think it was. I don't think this thing in Iraq is they're telling us the total truth about that either. And there's too many things that's happened, and they've changed the reasons for our being there so many times. And when you're in a combat situation and you're having to receive your orders from somebody 8,000-10,000 miles away, and you got to wait to see what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And this very same thing, I saw on television 2 nights ago on Fox News, there was a retired general on there, and he said right on Fox News, he said, we got to get politics out of this mess, and we've got to turn it over to the troops in the field, to the commanders over there, and let them fight it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, this is why we lost the Vietnam War, is because we were taking orders from Washington, D.C. We couldn't make a move until we got orders from Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
And so that was enough to tear the morale of the troops apart. I mean, there just wasn't any, nobody cared. They were just, mm-hmm. And their whole idea was just to get out of there alive.
Mm-hmm.
So, and as far as winning the battle, they just won what they had to, you know, that was it. What was forced on them, they did the best they could there, but because of it, we lost a lot of troops because of the morale factor.
Uh-huh. So you said some of the weaponry that you found came from this country for the North Vietnam?
Well, now, this I found out later. Since I've been out of Vietnam and since over the past 30 years or so, I've been checking up on it to find out. And I don't know who it was that was doing this, Chris, mm-hmm. but there was somebody in this country, and this has been proven over and over, that were shuttling weapons through Russia into North Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and American-made weapons, and we got more American weapons from the Viet Cong than we had ourselves. I spent a lot of nights in a revetment wasn't even armed, and this night when I was telling you about there when we gathered up that bunch of weapons,
mm-hmm.
I also took a crowbar and pulled a lock off of the armory and armed my troops. We didn't even have weapons at that point in time, and they were all locked up in this armory. So I took a crowbar and pried the lock off of it and armed my troops. And that's so.
So you you used the enemy's weapons to defend yourselves?
Well, no, we had our own weapons. We took them out of the armory there. We just put the ones that we had took back, those that 700 odd somewhere along there. I don't remember the exact number. We just took those and put them in the armory.
I see.
Yeah, and stored them away the next day. Of course, that night, we didn't even know we were coming up against American-made weapons, were you? Because they also had AK-47s, that's that Russian combat rifle. And
right.
With that. They had those, and we've took some Russian-made rocket launchers and things of this nature away from them. So that
AK-47 is alive and well in the Middle East today, isn't it?
Yep, sure is.
And that's just the way it is. The original inventor of the machine gun did it to stop war because he felt that once people knew how devastating this could be, nobody would want to fight.
but boy, did he make a mistake.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and this weapons of mass destruction that they are all the time pushing around.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
Weapons of mass destruction are very loosely defined.
Well, yeah. There's only one mm-hmm. weapon that I know of, and I was a weapons specialist in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one weapon that could reasonably be called a weapon of mass destruction, and that's the nuclear weapons.
Uh-huh.
Now they can be. They can truthfully be called a weapon of mass destruction because it's not just that small area where they kill a bunch of people, but the ones that was dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, Japan during when Harry Truman dropped them over there.
Mm-hmm.
These people down in the South Sea Islands that's still giving birth to deformed children, and there's a lot of birth defects, the different problems that those people are coming up with, and that's thousands of miles from Japan.
There wasn't a need to drop those bombs, by the way.
And no, well, now that's another story. I had to study this one to find it out. But when Harry Truman gave the order to drop those bombs, we were already in 300 air miles of Tokyo.
Right.
The Japanese were giving up. I mean, they were just throwing down their weapons and walking in.
Mm-hmm.
And that war, if they had went on for another year, both sides combined may have lost another 10,000 troops.
Mm-hmm.
There might have been another, say, 10,000 people killed. But as it was, there was millions of them that got destroyed.
Yeah.
And this was the thing about that. And the effects of that is not over yet. There's people still feeling the effects of it. So the fact
that they invented that bomb, and that was the Manhattan Project, they had to use it to scare the people of the world into accepting the United Nations.
This was the whole idea right there, to accept the United Nations. And The killing all those folks in Japan was is about as useless as anything it could be, but it served the purpose of politics, Chris.
We were doing many bombing raids with B-29s, being that we had that 300-mile distance, which was nothing for a B-29.
No, at...
And we were doing lots of bombing sorties over to Japan at the time anyway.
Yeah, there was... it was a daily occurrence that there was bombers over Japan.
And Japan's a very small country compared to this country. It's
about the size of
Southern California.
It's just an island out there, and a bomb dropped in Tokyo, for instance, and everybody in Japan probably is going to feel the effects of it. You know, just a conventional weapon, a bomb, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I have this document from 1936, and I've talked about it a lot lately, that it was a joint treaty by Germany and Japan in 1936
mm-hmm.
to fight the International Comintern, they call it, Communist International. And that was their goal in November 25th of 1936, was to fight international communism. And resist that, and we were part of that. We were the wrong side, weren't we?
Well, yeah. That's but it was all a part of. See, this New World Order thing, as far as this country's concerned, it got to be in effect in 1913 when they passed this Federal Reserve Act. And supposedly got the 16th Amendment of the Constitution ratified. There's some arguments or some confusion over that 16th Amendment. That's that tax amendment that gave Congress the authority to tax anybody from whatever source, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it's... all connected together that the Federal Reserve System, which is not a government entity, it's a commercial outfit that
uh-huh.
has nothing to do, no connection with the government at all, except that now, after all these years, it owns a government. That's it just owns our federal government. And but that and that 16th Amendment started all of this mess. And then after World War One was over and the troops had come home, they tried to start this League of Nations. And there was a very powerful congressman from Michigan, I think he was, or someplace up there, and didn't care for Woodrow Wilson, and he used his influence in Congress to stop that League of Nations, to stop the United Nations, States from getting into it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was supposed to been the, at the time, was slated to become the New World Order government, was that League of Nations.
Right.
But it didn't work out. So what they did, the people that had instigated this thing to get that in action, they formed this after this senator stopped the United States from getting into it. They formed the Council on Foreign Relations.
Uh-huh.
And there was a system, you know, you've heard of the Roaring Twenties, Chris.
Right.
Yeah, well, the way they arranged this was the fact that the banks, the Federal Reserve System, had what they called a call money system. And whereas if you had, say, $100 to invest in the stock market, you could go to a bank anywhere and you could borrow 10 times that amount to invest. And
uh-huh.
so you'd be investing $1,000 instead of $100. And that's just figures out of the blue that I got here. But that's, you see what the trend was there.
Uh-huh.
Well, the only thing wrong with the call money system was the fact that those loans were recallable within 24 hours. If the bank decided to call you on it, well, then you had 24 hours to either come up with the money or surrender your stock.
Wow.
And so this thing went on for about 8 years, really, that the people were using that call money system, the kind of like they're using credit cards nowadays. They was getting themselves so involved with the banks until just about everybody in this country owned stock, and they, because it was so easy to come by. And they owned it, and but in on October 6th in 1929, the Federal Reserve called in all of those call loans just overnight, bang.
When was this?
In October 6th in 1929.
Uh-huh.
And it threw this nation and the world practically into one of the worst depressions it's ever had. The first 10 years of my life, I come darn near starving to death, be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and because I was born in 1928. And then a year later, well, this depression happened. And because of the banks calling in all of these, the Federal Reserve calling in all those call loans. Well, I mean, this country went through about 10 years there or so, 10 or 12 years, to where we were broke. I mean, and when Franklin D. Roosevelt went in office, he declared the United States bankrupt. That was his, what they called, he called it a bank holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And he closed all of the banks in the country for one day. And then he only allowed the ones to open that he decided was solvent enough to meet the need or whatever, you know. So and but I know this country went through about 10 to 12 years of one of the worst depressions that the world has ever known. And
have we been bankrupt ever since?
Yep, we sure have. That's when we come off the gold standard and they started issuing us Federal Reserve notes instead of gold certificates.
And no one really knows that, even though it's written on our paper money on the front, legal tender for all debts, public and private.
That's right. But they don't turn it over. You turn a dollar bill over. I was talking to some people here in a gathering here. It wasn't any official meeting or anything of any kind. It was just a meeting of neighbors or what have you. And this came up about this. And I pulled a dollar bill out of my pocket, and I threw it at this one guy, and I said, "How much is that worth?" And he says, "It's worth a dollar." And I said, "Wrong, buddy." Because you go to a grocery store with that, and it's going to cost you half of it in tax. So, actually, the purchasing power of that certificate you got, that note that you've got there in your hand, is only about half of what the face value of that note is.
Uh-huh.
And beyond that, it costs the government about 2 cents to print these things, and they're printing them every day, the Federal Reserve.
Uh-huh.
And when you go into all of this business, Chris, about how this government, as this country, has paid its debt since 1933, it'll blow your mind. And if they ever paid off the national debt, they keep talking about paying it down and getting rid of it and doing this and doing that. But there ain't no way they can pay off that national debt. If they do, everybody in this country's going flat busted. It'll be flat on its back. And so the only thing that there's a lot of people talking now about what they refer to as a cashless society.
Uh-huh.
They'll issue everybody a credit card, and you'll be using a credit card instead of money when you go in. And that's the way they seem to have it right now. I don't think really that's the plan. I think there's a lot of other ways they're going to do this that can happen, because that really doesn't make sense there. But
you know, I see here from the Congressional Record, 1932.
Uh-huh.
It's McFadden, Lewis McFadden, and he's stating to the Chairman of the House, at this present session of Congress, we have been dealing with emergency situations. We have been dealing with the effect of things rather than with the cause of things.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, Mr. Chairman, we have in this country one of the most corrupt institutions the world has ever known. I refer to the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks. The Federal Reserve Board is a government board, has cheated the government of the United States and the people of the United States out of enough money to pay the national debt. The depredations and the inequities of the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks acting together have cost this country enough money to pay the national debt several times over. This evil institution, he says, has impoverished and ruined the people of the United States, has bankrupted itself, and has practically bankrupted our government. He goes on to state in another section, some people think the Federal Reserve Banks are United States government institutions. They are not government institutions. They are private credit monopolies which prey upon the people of the United States for the benefit of themselves and their foreign customers, foreign and domestic speculators and swindlers, the rich and predatory money lenders. In that dark crew of financial pirates, there are those who would cut a man's throat to get a dollar out of his pocket. There are those who send money into states to buy votes to control our legislation. And there are those who maintain an international propaganda for the purpose of deceiving us and of weeding us into the granting of new concessions, which will permit them to cover up their past misdeeds and set again in motion their gigantic train of crime. There's much more to this, but this is back in 1932, June 10th, 1932, Lewis McFadden.
Yeah, now that's true. That's what happened. Now, what was his name, the president just before Roosevelt?
Richard Hoover. What was his
Hoover,
name?
Yeah, Herbert Hoover.
Hoover. Yeah.
Now, he went to during his...
Keep your thoughts in place now on this.
Okay.
As we're going into the second hour, Ira from Moffat, Colorado is our guest. We're picking his brain to lead us to the ultimate situation we're in today, listeners, and we have the second hour to do this. So stay tuned for that, people, and it's not pleasant. It's just the facts, listeners. That's only what we deal with here are the facts. We'll be back to continue. Stay with us.
You are listening to the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network. We do not have freedom of speech because the Constitution gives it to us. The constitutional amendment was written to keep the government from taking our freedom away. The Creator gave us our rights, but He also gives us the capacity to do evil or usurp the rights of others. Our individual rights end where the rights of another begin. No one has the right to do evil because evil can never be right. Those who would seek to limit your right to speak or hear the truth are the same who seek to subjugate, control, and enslave you. Freedom is not free. Support the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network by going to FirstAmendmentRadio.com on the Internet and following the instructions there.